When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week, and we drop some hot reviews right your way.
Smoking.
Somebody stop me from this first review. The Ultimates, number two. 10, excuse me.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Stop me. Stop myself. From Marvel, written by Dennis Kemp, art by Juan Fragueri. In this issue, the team is together. Tony Stark is slowly coming back to life, and they are attacking the new Red Skull as we find out some of the history of the Human Torch in particular. Most of this is told from his perspective, and we get some big twists and turns here. Justin, this is one of your favorite titles.
You love this.
Month in and month out.
Yeah. You guys all right? Are you having a couple micro strokes over there? Both of you are just like, Abbott, Eep, Ubu. Why don't you guys take a lap, grab a little water, let me just, I'll talk about Ultimates, and then we'll get back into it.
Great.
I love this book. This book's all about balance. I think Dennis Kemp and Juan Fragueri is excellent on the art, but specifically the writing, I feel like Dennis Kemp is able to balance, like, just great superhero team fighting, attacking this base, taking down a Red Skull. Character, we get, this is all from the perspective of the Human Torch, a character we don't get a ton of stories about. This is not Johnny Storm. This is the robot Human Torch from the original Invaders. Very cool. We get some incorporation of real-world ideas into this. Hard to do. And then we get just an excellent reveal at the end that is terrifying and exciting. And still, the pressure and pace of this coming down, this whole Ultimates universe coming to a huge confrontation in 8 months is very exciting. Like, this book has it all.
Pete has a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. I just feel I want to be excited about it, but the problem is I've been reading comics too long. And so let me get this straight. The Ultimate situation is, what if, like, hey.
Wait, hold on. Spoilers past this point. Go ahead, Pete.
Okay, thank you. Good call. Great call.
How'd you know? How'd you sense? Your spoiler sense is tingling there.
Yeah.
Hey. It's either a stroke or I know how Pete works.
So, you know what's really cool in DC is when Robin was the Red Hood. Oh, why don't we do that with Bucky Barnes here and kind of do a Red Hood situation, but it's a Red Skull. What?
It's interesting you say that. There was this title, there was this guy named Ed Brubaker wrote a while back where he did this storyline where Bucky came back as a character called the Winter Soldier. I know you haven't read a lot of the comic books or seen any of the movies or anything like that, but that's what this is like, not what you just said.
Well, either way, it seems like it's a something we've seen before.
I disagree. I think it's actually handled really well because it's sort of ticked out. It's because the story isn't about revealing who's under the mask, under the skull, as it were. It's just we happen to get that reveal. So to me, it snuck up on me in a really appropriately done way, and I enjoyed it.
What about the Neymar butterfly situation? You think that was fucked up? You know, just pin him up against a board like he's a butterfly or something?
No, I think that was cool.
Yeah, it was a great trophy.
Oh, I have plenty of humans pinned to my wall.
What?
Half honestly, humans. Sorry, half humans.
Yeah, he's an Atlantean mutant, Alex. Mm-hmm.
I thought this was great as well, particularly starting off with a scene of Hitler being burnt and the whole speech that Jim Hammond gives deleted a lot of my memories. I deleted this important one and this important one. But you know what I keep? Burning Hitler.
Burning that Hitler.
Yeah, it's my rainy day. Burning Hitler.
Right. And
that's his Ted Lasso, Pete.
To get, instead of believe, it's Bert and Hitler. I have a sign right over the door. Pete, to get back to the point you were making, we don't know exactly what this Bucky being the new Red Skull means, but the whole idea of the entire issue is how fascism doesn't go away. It just gains other forms, and that is what we are getting through.
So you've got to always be burning Hitler is what you're saying.
Yes, that actually is. I know you're making a joke, but that I think 100% is the punch Nazis Jack Kirby idea they are trying to get through in this issue, and that comes through in Captain America being presented with his worst nightmare, which is somebody that he loves and cares about has also been corrupted by this terrible world. So it gives them yet another thing to fight against that, just like in our real world, we may not be able to wipe out entirely.
And here's the genius or the smart choice here is that we're not getting this from Cap's perspective. We get it from someone else's perspective, someone who is sort of unemotional as an android, Human Torch. And that, I think, is such a strong choice because it lets it be information. It lets it be observation. And that just makes for a story that we haven't seen before, I would argue, Pete, because we've seen Cap being pissed that Bucky is fucked up a ton of times. We get it from an outside perspective here, and I think that's why it works.
Yep. Why don't we move on and talk about Secret Six, number one from DC Comics, written by Nicole Maines, art by Steven Segovia. Here we are following up, for the majority of the issue, mostly on Absolute Power. Amanda Waller has been locked away. Pete is getting jazzy as heck. And Dreamer, John Kent, and John Kent's boyfriend, Jay Nakamura, have a very complicated relationship for a variety of circumstances I will not describe here. but what I think they do really smartly and really well in this book is use those insanely complicated people dying and coming back and going through dreams complications to give some really palpable drama in this book that plays out here, but never forgets about the superheroics in the middle of this. As the plot of the book is, Amanda Waller is missing. Nobody believes them for whatever reason, and they have to figure out where she's gone and why. So I was very excited about this. I think this is another winner in the ongoing Dreamer storyline. Really like Jay and John as supporting cast members here, and there's some fun action stuff and twists that happen throughout.
Yeah, I agree. This is a lot of fun. Fun cover. I love how exciting this is. This is great story, cool team, great setup, awesome art. I feel like this is a solid first issue. Like Alex said on the live show, I was a fan of the Gail Simone Secret Six, so I was excited to pick this up. And I think they did a great job of really kind of setting this world up in an interesting way.
I mean, I would say, I agree about Gail Simone's Secret Six. This feels very different. It feels like it's coming at it from a completely different angle, using a lot of continuity on the front end, which, and then maybe landing there in a sort of more classic Secret Six story. I also really like Dreamer. I like the character choices here. I did want to highlight one thing that I thought was really funny. There's a moment where Dreamer's were in her internal monologue, and she's like, just like in my dream, it couldn't be. And I'm like, Dreamer, you dreamed it. Yeah. It's probably some shit. That's your whole thing, girl.
It's like your whole thing.
You can't be surprised at your dreams coming true when your name is Dreamer and your whole thing is dreams.
Yeah.
So,
and to clarify about the Gail Simone thing, love the Gail Simone Secret Six run. I agree with you that this does feel different. And I think that's a good thing, ultimately. Like, trying to ape that and go for the same tone there is just not going to work. But at the same note, it's nice to see Catman back, Black Alice, etc. So it's a fun mix.
Fun.
Excited to see where this goes. Next up, The Herculoids, number one from Dynamite, written by Tom Snegowski, art by Craig Rousseau. A couple of weeks back, we had Tom on the show, and we talked to him about The Herculoids. I had no experience with the show. You guys were fans, though. So now that he's off the show,
what? And so, Alex, you emerged from your clone tube at, 16, 21? Into college? I forget exactly how it worked.
Yeah, exactly. It was a whole, sixth day scenario. Wait, is it sixth day or
Schwarzenegger? Are you comparing yourself
Schwarzenegger
to Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, Schwarzenegger did two movies that both had six in the title. Oh, End of Days of the Sixth Day. I am thinking of the Sixth Day.
Yes, it's the sixth day you're talking about.
That almost didn't work. That almost didn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's too bad you don't have Total Recall.
Here's the thing is, clones can't talk about clone movies, and that's how we know Alex is a clone.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's crazy that Alex is unfamiliar with the Herculoids, a group of characters that were so striking to me when they were replayed on Saturday mornings when I was a kid.
Yep.
And these are great artifacts to track down. And this is, pardon the sort of tangential anecdote, I was watching there's a Dungeons & Dragons network on Samsung TV Plus that was just showing the old cartoon today on a run. And I'll tell you what, that cartoon is sort of bad, but sort of good. And Herculoids has the same vibe.
Yeah, what was interesting was I was a huge fan of Herculoids as a kid, loved watching it. This is great. I feel like it does a great job of getting us excited for this world and what's to come. The kind of rougher edge that it's taking is it's a little bit like, hey, remember Herculoids? You ever think about the fact that anyone who tried to visit them was immediately murdered and they always worked together to just kill anything that came close to them? Huh, I didn't remember that part, but that's a hot take to take on it. So, yeah, this is a little bit of the darker version of what I'm used to, but I'm here for it, man. I'm excited for this. And it's just fun to see everybody again. And, yeah, I'm loving this nostalgia bath.
The old gang. I will say we talked to Tom about this on the live show. But these characters are sort of a combination of, like, aliens, dinosaurs, and superheroes. Like,
yep.
every child's favorite thing, at least my favorite thing when I was a kid. So that's awesome, and it does a good job of actually using all of those elements together. Sort of holds the Herculoids for a little bit in the beginning, which I was surprised about, but it actually worked here. And according to Tom, like, this moves pretty quickly into some interesting areas as it moves forward out of this issue, so that's really cool.
Yeah.
Excited
and last thing I will say, as somebody who doesn't care about this or know about this at all, I enjoyed it as well. These are two guys who have worked extensively on the Mignola-verse, the Hellboy books, and otherwise. And I think this really channels that nicely. It's a very different thing, but if you are a fan of their work on those books, definitely check this out. Shazam, number 21 from DC Comics, written by Josie Campbell, art by Dan McDade. This is, surprisingly to me, the last issue of this title.
Oh, man.
Which is really unfortunate. And it's doubly unfortunate because two issues back, issue 19, was this great cliffhanger where Mr. Mind took over the entire world. And I was like, here we go. Huge Shazam event incoming. Next issue was a very fun, very lovely one-shot that was out of that continuity by Cedar Grace. Again, very fun. And I was like, this issue, getting back to it, I was like, great, here we go with the Mr. Mind thing. It's going to last all the way, I'm sure, to issue 25, except not at all. And Josie Campbell is a pro, so she does a good job of wrapping it up as ably as possible. But man, you can just feel reading this issue where this was initially like a 4 to 5 issue arc at the very least. And it's a real bummer because this was a really good, really fun all ages book that I really enjoyed. I wish there was more of it.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like every time I read this, I was surprised how much I liked it. I was kind of like, oh, yeah, this is great. And they did such a great job with this book. And it is all ages, but it really hits on a lot of different levels. So this was impressive comics. So it's sad to see it go. This did wrap up nicely, though, in a good way that's worth checking out. So, yeah, I hear what the Zalbatron saying of it, it felt like a bigger story that had to kind of get condensed, but it still landed in a nice way. So definitely think it's worth checking out.
Yeah, was it Mark Waid that kicked this off and did the first like 12 to 15? And then Josie Campbell took over. And again, I liked Mark Waid's run on it, but I think Josie Campbell like brought a different energy that really was working here. And like Alex is saying, or like we're all saying, like it's especially sad to see that go when a comic is really clicking a character that is can be difficult to sort of find the right niche for, like Shazam and the rest of the family, the Shazamly, as Alex says.
I love saying that.
You do. So, like, it is sad to see it go, but this issue closes it out in a fun way. I hate to say it, but it's a great cover. That's something Pete says.
It is a really good cover. This is a great piece of Shazam art. It's really nice. Now, we're going to move to a big event at Marvel, but we're not going to the Doom Room because it is time for the X-Man hunt to begin.
What?
This is... I know.
We're on the hunt.
We're on the hunt. Move over, Blood Hunt. It's time for X-Man Hunt. And as we all know, X-Men don't have any blood.
Yes, what? Famously bloodless.
I have nothing else to say about this. Now, so this is a very concise event that is running just over the course of this month, over 8 issues. We get 3 issues this week. So I'll just read them off now, even though we should probably talk about them each a little separately.
We should.
Kicks off with Uncanny X-Men number 11, written by Gail Simone, art by Javier Garon. NYX number 9 is part 2, written by Jackson Kelly and Colin Lansing, art by Francesco Mortarino. And part 3 is Storm number 6, written by Murua Ayodele, art by Luciano Vecchio. I'll
talk with this one first.
Yes, we'll talk about the first issue first, but I want to talk about overall here because I was very curious to see, okay, what is this event going to be like? We talked a lot about Raid on Gray Malkin, was this weird structure, it was 4 issues, but they kept backing up just in case you were only reading X-Men or Uncanny X-Men. Yeah. So here they have a chance to do like a classic X-Men crossover.
Classic.
From back
your classic
in the day.
Executioner's song is sort of
exactly
what came to mind
something like
this.
That, and I do love that tiny little Professor X who's running across the top of the cover. That's a very fun logo design. He gets a little farther every issue, so that's very cute.
Oh man, that's fun!
It is very fun. What is going on here? I have things that I liked about each of these issues individually, but we start off with Uncanny X-Men with Professor Xavier in prison being like, no, this daughter of mine in space, she's in trouble. I got to get out of here. And they're like, oh, no, nothing we could have done to stop Professor X from getting out. And the next issue is like, well, I'm in New York for an unrelated reason. And then the third issue is like, now I'm all the way in San Francisco with Storm. I cannot get a grasp on this overall story at all.
Well, you see how it works is he's taking planes from different locations.
Yeah, you want to see him on a plane, Alex?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to see him on a plane, but I do want
to... What about a train?
Nobody seems to be chasing him right now. Like, he's on an X-Man hunt, and nobody seems to be chasing after Professor
Or
X.
Care, yeah. Well, let's talk about Uncanny X-Men a little bit. I think, first off, very cool cover. But I really love the badass kind of, like, Deathbird moment we got in this. I thought that was great, and I would like some more of that. But yeah, this is just Charles being a dick to everyone. This is classic. And he's like, I'm going to go help my daughter. I don't care if I kill everybody in the process. And it's like, cool.
Well, I think let's to slow it down a little bit. I think there's...
Justin, slow it down.
We got to slow it down because there's...
Too fast.
I want to start in sort of with a couple points to get into this. Because I think the way Charles Xavier has been sort of portrayed in the X universe in the last, I don't know, 10 years really has been, he's gone from like mentor and like revered figure to like basically a villain.
Yep.
Agreed. At the very least, everyone is like, well, you can't trust him. And at the most, he's like, get him. He's killing people. So I think that's problematic for the way this story is structured, where, like you're saying, we are literally riding with him and meant to root for him escaping. Despite the fact that in this first issue, the Uncanny X-Men, it's the team trying to get him on behalf of the villain. I was like, this is a weird topsy-turvy thing.
Right.
So, A, that's where we are, and that's a little uncomfortable storytelling position. B, we have this the fact that he is the father of Xandra, with Lilandra is the mother, Deathbird, her sister, a mutant, in space. Something that is true in continuity, but is not really said in this comic. And I think they should say that because that would help. That would make me realize, yes, Professor X should want to do anything he can to save his family. And if they had just set that up a little bit more, I think this whole event would play much stronger. I like this. I like the way each of these three issues tells us a little bit about Professor X from a slightly different perspective, which I think tracks. Like, in this, the Uncanny X-Men issue, he is sort of, like, cautiously approached by his students. He's a hero and a villain to them. All of them, it feels like, in this issue. And the NYX story, they're like, yo, you're a fallen from grace. He's almost like a canceled figure for them.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And then in the Storm issue, he's sort of like an equal almost. I mean, she's powered. She's super overpowered right now, Storm, because of her work with Eternity, as we've seen over the course of these issues.
Well, let's, come on, dude. You're getting, let's slow this down.
I'm just saying.
Stop trying to get ahead of yourself.
To your point, Alex, it feels disjointed, but I actually like the different flavors each book is providing. I just think they have he's a difficult character because he's inconsistent, A, and B, they didn't set this up properly.
Okay, so then we get the NYX one here, where everybody's talking about the seed.
And real quick, ignoring everything you said and moving on.
I'm not ignoring. He said his thoughts very nicely and concisely.
But is there anything else you want to say about this issue? Because I actually think this issue was one of the better Uncanny X-Men issues across all of the storytelling.
I was surprised how much I liked this, even though this is kind of chaos candy. But I do think that it's... I was surprised how much I like this.
Chaos candy is like Good and Plenty's, or like, what do you think? Like those fucked up Oreos, Alex?
No, that's like when you take a Good and Plenty and a Mike and Ike's box, put them all together, shake them up, and then put them back in the box so you don't know what you're getting.
Yeah, that's chaos.
That would kill me.
That is chaos. Imagine you tried to bite into a Mike and Ike.
I also generally was okay with this, and I think I would have liked it better if anything was followed up in the next two issues. But
makes sense.
Plus, I don't know. I don't understand the whole Gray Malkin prison thing exactly, the way that it's working. Like, just that they are abjectly evil and torturing mutants, but also, like you said, Rogue is working for them, which I know spins off of, I guess, the end of the Raid on Gray Malkin crossover.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if they had positioned them as like, well, we're trying to do the right thing here, Professor Xavier is a criminal, and everybody's like, we agree. And then they were holding these other criminals, and everybody was like, we agree. And they're like, well, but we're pushing it a little bit. They're like, no. But instead, they are abjectly as bad as, like, Cameron Hodge holding a bunch of mutants in a prison. And
they're torturing the mutants.
Exactly.
So, like, and it's, that's what I'm saying. I agree with you. And if they – I think they're pinning it on, like you're saying, that, like, Professor X is actually – he committed some crimes. I'm like, make that clear. Make that clear what it is.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm like, I don't want to be critical because I like all these creators and I like this story, but like, it's almost like an editorial thing. Like, clarify some of this stuff. And what I think we need, overarching idea, we need a Professor X standalone comic that is, I hope, redemptive, but, or just make a choice. Is he a hero or a villain? Put him there.
You know, to that point, like, not to play backseat editor, but this probably would not have sold as well, and I understand why they did this, but having a Professor X miniseries that kept it razor-focused on him would make it feel a lot less like, to turn it over to NYX, which I know Pete wants to talk about, like Professor X is coming in and interrupting. It's like NYX is in the middle of this party that's all about Mojo, and they're talking about Mojo, and they've got their, like, we're the kids in New York thing going on. And Professor X is like, by the way, I'm going to start playing my music real loud in here for a moment and then leave. And it's just, nobody seems to care. They're like, well, we don't trust Professor X, so we're going to go do our own thing. And Professor X is doing his own thing, but they don't really connect other than physically being in the same space.
Well, but I would say in this, Professor X is sort of the worst. He's like, hey, guys, I need you to rescue this Krakoan seed. And they're like, you got it. We'll do it for you, even though we don't trust you. And then he's like, gotcha, fuck you. I don't need that. I'm here for something else. And I was like, what?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
such a so dick that, move.
Why so, didn't you say one
so
of the
then,
other
here
thing?
We go. Because so in the last comic, it's like, okay, I'll murder anybody gets in the way. I'm going to go save my daughter. Oops, I got to go get my seed first because it's super important. I know it's weird we're talking about my daughter, but I need this seed for some reason. Oh, by the way, psych move, I just missed my lollipop helmet, so fuck all y'all. And I'm just like,
which
how
is hidden
this?
In Mojo's goop factory,
yeah,
which is a tree.
Hold on, though. There's a little more logic there. This was the X-Men's base. Mm-hmm. Right. And yes. So it makes sense that his lollipop helmet would be there. I like that they sort of combined the story they were already doing, which was about the Krakoan seed and Mojo, and they were like, okay, we can have Professor X fold in here and keep it going. So, like, it was messy just because it's smashing two things together, but there was an internal logic, I think.
Yeah, but think about, we've all seen this Seinfeld episode, right? Somebody's in the hospital, and then you show up, and you're eating juji fruit, and you're like, yeah, you stop for juji fruit? His daughter needs him, and he's like, yo, first I got to stop and get the seed first. He's going to show up. He's munching on giant seeds.
He doesn't want the seed. That's how he tricked, obviously, you and the NYX. Well,
he had to get his helmet. He had to get his helmet. But,
yeah, he was tricking the kids with the seed. The seed was a red herring so he could get the helmet. Because he needs the helmet for some reason that we're going to find out to go to space to save Xandra.
Oh, sure. So this was all part of the – it seemed like he was like – yo, hold on a second.
No wonder you
hate
it. Petey keeps tricking you.
Yeah. I did like all the meta fourth wall breaking stuff with Mojo, where he's talking about, like, I finally finished up this plot point from X-Men 23 or whatever it was. That was pretty fun. Yeah. I don't know why this never occurred to me before, but what's the deal with Professor X touching his head? Like, is that just an affectation, or does he need do that?
That's how he uses his powers.
But does
I don't
he
know. When I'm thinking really
he
hard, I go like this,
to.
Too.
Yeah. Do you?
He doesn't
when I'm
need
like,
to.
Everyone's like, oh, when did we go to Disney World? And I'm like,
it was two years ago.
Yeah. You use the sum totality of your psychic powers to figure
it's
that
a,
out,
it's
right?
a tick that he has.
I mean, it's fine. Let him do his thing.
Oh, my God.
I hate to be the ex-defender over here, but like, you're mad at him for touching his head. Cyclops touches his visor. Psylocke holds her hand up.
Cyclops touches his visor because he has to open it. There's a button on the side.
Yeah, he's got a little button on the side of his visor.
He does have a little button on the side.
Cyclops, seen this
Cyclops. He touches it every time. I bet you I could find a panel in a fucking heart.
I dare you. I'll give you $10,000 if you can find one panel of Cyclops shooting stuff out of his visor. Stuff, whatever that stuff is.
Storm number six.
Also, this is the first time I've ever read a comic book. Let's talk about Storm number six, which
has him using his visor.
But I'm going to say my favorite of the bunch. I continue to really enjoy this title. The art by Luciano Vecchio was great. The fights were great. And even though I maybe still had like a little trouble following the overall plot of the X-Manhunt stuff, I thought what Storm was doing was good, and what brought her into conflict with Cyclops' team was good.
Hey,
fun.
Alex, there's Cyclops shooting his eyes with his fucking hands up his visor.
Have you read a book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud? What happens between the panels is just as important. And one of the things that happened between the panels here was he touched his visor.
Is it an open and close? How does it work, Alex?
Yeah, it's an open and close.
Well, it doesn't just stay open then, I don't think.
I don't know.
In your face. You prove wrong the next comic. You just got stacked. You got stacked.
One of us shouted this out on the live show. I would like to talk about this comic. This is a fantastic issue. I've been really loving the Storm series. Hey, remember Maggot? He's in here. I thought this was just like a badass kind of start. That Thundercloud title page was really cool. Storm kicks the shit out of Cyclops. I got up out of my seat. I was so excited. And then Beast maybe gets ambushed by Lollipop Charles. So, you know, Charles is in there.
That stuff at the end was great. My favorite moment in the entire issue, which I could not believe, is after Storm electrocutes Cyclops, Juggernaut immediately being like, oh, no rules? Okay, time to rip off Maggot's arm.
Yes.
Like, no hesitation there, which I thought was an amazing moment.
It was wild. Well, let me
Poor
follow
Maggot.
That up.
He just showed up, and now he got his arms ripped off.
Well, let me follow up with my favorite moment of the issue, which is when Storm is helping the maggots heal Maggot. And she says, eat up and heal. Eat up and become my Omega Maggot.
That's great. That's what comics should be.
Well, and that's what this comic is going so hard in such a fun way by, like we're saying, sort of like Cyclops pressing or also not pressing the button on his visor. Truly cutting loose, letting Storm be like in the thrall of eternity at a point, dying in a couple issues ago, but then healing herself, having Maggot be her like bud, while still folding in the X-Manhunt stuff in a way that felt a little more natural than the other books, I would say.
Let me throw this out to you. Because Cyclops presses the side of his visor, as we've all established, to shoot out his concussion
Or he also does it sometimes.
Do you think Professor X, when he does this, should his brains, like, pour out of his ears?
I think, more specifically, he should not be able to think at all unless he's holding his hand on his side of his head. He should be like, duh, unless he's touching his head.
Maybe at the end of X-Men Hunt.
Am I in space yet, my guys?
Yeah, where's my daughter? Mothra, Queen of the Monsters, number one from IDW, written by Sophie Campbell, art by Matt Frank and Sophie Campbell. Pete loves this because
I do.
You love the sweet love between Mothra and Godzilla.
Well, I don't know about that, but first off, just glorious cover. Look at this fucking thing. I mean, come on. This is nice.
To expand out from the cover into the art. Really interesting art. I liked it. Very like hyper specific, yet the color was very spare and used very well, I thought. The color, I would like to shout out the colorist on this comic.
Yes.
Because it was excellent. And that
jumps off the page. It's very enjoyable.
Matt Frank and Sophie Campbell are the credited artists.
Yeah, I love Godzilla. I love Godzilla's world. So this we get Queen of the Monsters here with Mothra. Mothra sometimes gets a bad rap, so it's nice to get a little Mothra love in this. I did really understand, the argument over, like, when someone hands you a decorative bikini and you're like, yo, I'm going to wear pants because we got some shit to do and I ain't got time for a bikini. So I know it's an old argument, but I appreciate it.
You
got to
refuse a gift like that? You got to at least put it on.
Hey, if it's something that you got to wear, you get a say. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
I don't know that much about Mothra, so as is becoming a repeated theme, felt a little bit lost at points here when they were like, oh, the fairies are here. They want us to do something. I was like, what?
Well, you've never seen it?
That is from the movies, and it was – they commit to it like you have just finished watching all of these movies. So shouts to that. But like, yes, I understand why you're lost. Let me ask you, is Godzilla king of the monsters?
Yeah.
Are Mothra and Godzilla married, or how does that work?
No.
Well, how is she queen and he's king? Isn't that a marriage?
Yeah.
That's a title,
is it a marriage
man.
Of convenience,
it gets,
or
it gets
are they
thrown around? It's, you know.
You know what would be great is the sort of thing if, like, they got together.
Do you think Queen Latifah has to put up with this shit? You think people walk up to Queen Latifah and go and be like, hey, who's the king?
No, if there was someone who was calling themselves King Latifah, I feel like it'd be like, hey, are you guys connected in any way? You guys friends? Or what's the deal with you two?
I mean, there's King Kong, you know what I mean? And then there's guys.
Is she married to King Kong?
No.
Oh.
Maybe it's someone's fanfic, you know?
I love how, Pete, you're confidently answering these questions, but you're also, like, doubting everything at the same time.
That's right. That's how I roll.
You're like, are they married? And you're like, no. I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know. It's just a difficult wedding. It's like, you ever watch The Crown? That's complicated, too. But you're not grilling me about that, are you?
I feel like I got to go to AO3 and see if there's any King Kong, Queen Latifah fic, but I also don't want to know.
King Kong and Queen Latifah are married. Just to
100%. But Mothra and Godzilla, question marks.
So I think this is a lot of fun. I like this. Sisters in here. It makes sense that, the one person's angry and blames Mothra. So it was kind of cool to see that clash.
Yeah, I like that there were sisters and a large moth. I agree. Next up. No, I like this book.
Wow.
It's just there are sisters. I don't know if that's a quality that I'd be like, good book for. But anyway.
I'm talking about the two sisters in the books that were separated for 15 years. And then.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, I think it's a good... I enjoyed this read.
Okay, I don't know what happened there. Two-Face, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Christian Ward, art by Fabio Veras. In this issue, Harvey Dent and Two-Face are really having it out inside their head for who's going to take control of the body. We get a revamped origin story, kind of, or part of an origin story for Two-Face as well. I continue to really like this series. I thought this was really fascinating, journeying through Harvey's mindscape, beautiful art throughout. I like the series a lot.
Yeah.
Same.
Go ahead.
I feel like this book each issue feels like, oh, I'm surprised they're doing this. It feels so unique and specific, and I'm just glad they are. Like, the art's really great. If you're a fan at all of Two-Face, this is just a great exploration. I like the term scarvy that we sort of get yeah. for the dark side of Harvey. There's, yes, like Alex was saying, there's some great origin stuff here and great reveals by the end of it. Really good.
Crazy intense cover here. Amazing art. I feel like the artist is the real hero here. I don't know. The twist at the end, spoilers, but the mom reveal, I was a little like, but yeah.
You don't like moms?
Oh, I like moms. I got a lot of respect for mom, but the reveal, I was just kind of like, I don't know.
You're more of a grandmom guy.
It hit me a little like anticlimactic.
Star Wars Jedi Knights, number one from Marvel, written by Mark Guggenheim, art by Matabak Musabekov. This is taking place in the prequel era and bringing together a bunch of Jedi Knights for the first time in comics, at least this way. We talked to Mark Guggenheim about this at Fan Expo yes. Norwich. You can listen to the podcast version of that. But what did you guys think about this book?
I really like this. And, you know, these books can often be dense. And I think Mark Guggenheim does a good job of, like, keeping it clean, keeping the story, like, really digestible. And there's so many Jedi Knights introduced here. And he's able to juggle them and sort of give each their due. But I have a sort of a larger question for you guys. Do you think, like, Yoda talks the way he talks?
Right.
And as I'm reading this issue, I'm realizing that I think that was something that I thought was just like an old person thing, and that a younger Yoda would talk like sort of in the right order. Like, I think like in my mind,
so
I was
the
like,
older Yoda got, the more he kind of started messing up like words in his
like
head.
I feel like Yoda is sundowning.
Like a Yogi Berra situation?
He's sundowning in the original trilogy, oh. And I want him to talk regular in this comic book.
Huh. Wow. I don't know how I feel about a young Yoda talking regularly.
Well, but this is set in the Phantom Menace era, where he was still old and he still talked like that, because it's only 30, 35 years before, something like that.
Are we just saying that all of the Yoda species talks like that?
So I don't think so. I don't remember where this is from, but I believe they established that, no, it's just Yoda being a weirdo, apparently. Mm-hmm.
It's so he has like a brain injury?
It's a twisted sense of humor. He thinks it's funny.
Yeah. It's a joke?
Yeah.
That would be the wildest reveal.
I don't know if that was what they said. But I do remember, I think it was like Dave Filoni or something, gave an interview because like they had Yaddle dialogue, and Yaddle is the same race, and she didn't talk like
that.
Yeah,
Yaddle talks normal.
Yeah. So there you go.
Anyways.
I'm just saying.
Speaking of freak.
Speaking of the larger thing, let's just, you know, when you hear Jedi Knights, I think of Baywatch Knights. So, you know, that was a little...
That's like, what everyone's... That's
yeah, that's everyone's everybody's going through that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my big question reading this book is, where's the beach?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I like how David Hasselhoff is, the beach, where is it?
Yeah.
The beach, where is
it? Don't hassle the Hoff. So, yeah, I think it, you know, starts really fun with this giant fight, and it's fun to hear the quips from Mace Windu and Yoda going back and forth. And then you got to get, you know, you get some possible futures and some, you know, spoilers, but you get like a possible evil Yoda here, which really kind of freaked me out and scarred me. And I didn't like that image.
Scarred.
Yeah, I didn't like that image in my head, and I didn't appreciate it. It kind of messed with me more than I was ready for. But I feel like this is a great story, and it's in good hands.
Because one of the, just to say, one of the Jedis is having visions of Sith Yoda.
Oh.
Or the Sith Yoda.
And I think that's Obi-Wan, right? Species.
Yes, Obi-Wan is having those visions.
So, yeah, I really like that. I like the end the best of this issue, I think, just because it did seem to set up something that feels fresh and exciting and new. I like the rest of the issue just fine. But...
And to be clear, you're talking about the end where they're like, who stabbed?
What?
What?
Who got stabbed?
No, Qui-Gon Jinn got stabbed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but it kind of ended with this panel where he's looking out at us, reader, like, who got?
Oh, yes, he is sort of surprised at us. Ooh,
yeah.
I also think it's funny in this where, like, the text is describing, giving us a little vibe check on all the Jedis, and they're like, Qui-Gon Jinn, Maverick. I was like, Maverick? He's, like, the most chill, like, statesman in all of those movies, of all the Jedi we know.
Taken. Darkwing Duck, number one from Dynamite, written by Daniel Kibblesmith, art by Brandt and Stein. This is sort of a Darkwing Duck year one with him telling his grandniece, I believe, because all ducks, no ducks have children in this world. I mean, there are duck children, but there's no direct duck children. They're all nieces and nephews. Anyway,
Conspiracy theory.
What did you just do?
I'm just throwing that out there. I'm just throwing it out there.
I mean, to be fair, I believe, he is not, he's Goslin's uncle, right?
Yeah. So he is telling her the story of his origin and trying to figure out his arch enemy in this issue. I thought this was great. A lot of fun.
No, wait, sorry. It is, she says Earth to Dad.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Goslin Mallard, daughter of Drake Mallard. She's adopted, though. She's adopted.
Oh, sorry. I didn't read this.
I mean, this is another nostalgia bath for me that is so great. I mean, the line that says...
Real quick, before you go any further, what is the origin of nostalgia bath? I just have to, like, you use it like it's something that everyone says. Yeah. And no one's heard it anywhere but on this very podcast. And you just said, like, is that something...
I got a lot of weird sayings. I don't know what to tell you.
So are you saying, like, you dip into this and it's like a nostalgia bath. It's washing over you.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a nice way to revisit something from your past, you know, in a nice little bath situation.
So just to give us the image, how does that work? You're reading this and you're, like, closing your eyes and laying down on the bed.
Yeah. Like or a couch, you know, just kind of just being like, oh, man, this is just so nice. Look at how warm the water is.
Are you rubbing your tummy a little bit when you're doing that?
Yeah, describe the rubbing.
That got weird. Anyways, I just felt like this was felt like the old TV show. Felt like the animation is similar. It just has a great look to it that makes you think of the old show. The line that I wrote down here: "I'm the cold blast of water in the confusing hotel shower of justice." I mean, that's just hysterical. That's just fun great stuff. Darkwing Duck lines there, and it's really fun. And great art, great story. This is a blast.
Daniel Kibblesmith captures the tone of the show while refreshing it in the modern world in this comic. It is great. Reading this, like, I loved this show when I was a kid, especially, like, this was on such a run of Disney afternoon cartoons that was awesome. But then when they announced the one that was combining superheroes and Disney characters, I was like, oh, hell yeah. And so this definitely does not disappoint. I always think it's so strange/great that this TV show and now this comic incorporated Launchpad McQuack. Why? Doesn't make any sense. They pulled him from DuckTales and was like, we got to have him here. I was like, DuckTales. It's like a Frasier-style spinoff with Launchpad. And, like, shouts to that. It's weird, but I love it.
Who else is he going to interact with? You know, you got to throw in Launchpad.
Every other show made new characters. This one was like, well, let's bring Launchpad over. His whole thing is crashing planes. That's literally his whole thing. And he's like, I walked away again.
Yeah,
and
but then he walks like, away, so it's fine.
Yeah, no. It works.
Any crash you walk away from. Batgirl number 5 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Takeshi Miyazawa. In this issue, Batgirl continues to wrestle with the legacy her mother has left her. Pete, you love this one. Take it away.
Yeah, I mean, first off, this is a glorious cover. I mean, come on, look at this cover. This is glorious here. This is fantastic art. This is art that should be held up and studied for years.
Stop yelling at the listeners.
Okay, sorry. I love this Batgirl story. I love how much time we're getting to spend in her head. All the mom stuff is very interesting. We don't usually get to see them interact together. So this is just new and fun and exciting, but feels like the old Batgirl we know and love. So I feel like this is a great place for her to be, a little off her game. It's kind of fun to see. And I'm just having such a blast with this. This is the total package here. This is badass, man. Come on.
Spoiler, but I love spoiler, and it's a spoiler to say that spoiler shows up in this issue in a cool way.
I'm really enjoying this title as well. I, like I said, from the beginning, I was okay with it, but it has grown better and better every issue, so very much on board. Doctor Strange...
Sorry, real quick before we move on, I did want to highlight the art here, which I think, even just in this issue alone, moves through a couple different styles in the different sections of the book. And the book, you know, a lot of books are like, we're going to do a silent issue. And this issue, like, moves through some, like, silent sequences while also having dialogue-heavy sequences and just really having Takeshi Miyazawa do both in a great way. And the sequence with Spoiler was really cool and different from the rest of the book in a great way.
Worth it for the art alone.
Doctor Strange of Asgard, number one from Marvel, written by Derek Landy, art by Carlos Magno. Per the title, Doctor Strange is no longer the Sorcerer Supreme of Earth, so he heads to Asgard to try to be the Sorcerer Supreme there, and things do not go smoothly on his first day applying for the job, I gotta say. I like the concept of this okay, but I found something wasn't quite working for me in terms of the art. It was a little too exaggerated, and panels kept falling into each other. Huh. So I found it a little hard to follow the action on this sometimes. Oh, sounds weird. Like you guys did not feel the same.
No, I really love the art style and the kind of pushes that it was making and the choices that it was making. I thought it was a cool, look to it. But yeah, I really thought that this was I thought you were going to say you got tired of them being like, oh, well, Asgard hasn't had, they've always had this job, but never Sorcerer Supreme. I thought that was the thing that they kept hitting.
As somebody who's out of work, I love hearing about jobs.
Have you thought about just going to, a different plane of existence and applying for jobs there?
Not yet, but.
You can just go to Asgard and be like, can I be the editor here?
Yeah. Like, well, we haven't had an editor in a long time, but I guess you could.
You got to go ask this someone who sort of edits if you could be the editor. And then, careful, don't get involved in a mystery around something bad that happened.
Well,
yeah, the twist, though, that kind of happens at the end of this is kind of crazy. So that was a real kind of like, oh, shit moment. But yeah, I enjoyed the setup and the art for this. It was fun.
I mean, I like the art in this. Like, the art didn't bother me, but I do think it's a lot of pipe to lay for it to be like, so Doctor Strange got kicked out of his job by Doctor Doom, and that's a whole other thing going on. So he went to another place, and he was like, can I be the doctor here? And they were like, sort of, but not really. You have to go talk to someone. You can still use magic, but not real magic. But these other people use magic, and Loki especially uses magic. So the magic is a little different here. But if you talk to the right person, you can get the job, and then you're going to be superpowered. But turns out, continuity-wise, you actually used to use this magic for a while ago because you have this stick in your pocket that I need back if you want to hold on to the magic that we're going to give you if you give it this time. Like, it is a lot of going on here, but it's built around the premise of some being like, hey, they fired me from my job in this town, could I come to your town and be the dentist? Which feels like, oh, that's not how it should work.
Yeah,
I mean, right. I think the message is always return people's sticks.
Yes. No context necessary. Next up, Sister Imperator number one from Dark Horse Comics. Created by Tobias Forge, written by Karina Becco, art by Pust. I don't know if I got any of those words correct, to be honest with you.
Oh, my God.
Pust.
So this is based on a album, I want to say, from the Bad Ghost that they are adapting, and it follows a woman who has a really hard life. And the guy who's interviewing her, what did you guys think?
I mean, this lady fucked up a lot of. I'm curious what the album sounds like.
Ghost is a pretty hardcore band. I have a bunch of friends who really love their music.
Really, and do they sing about the twins here? And like
they sing like a lot. It's like a kind of like a heavy metal type of vibe. So.
I could see this working better with music because there are things, just to call out a specific phrase, there's a thing early on because she kills this dude and all the reporters are asking her questions about it. And one of the reporters is like, they say the punishment fits the crime, so why did you commit this crime? And she's like, I like you. I'm going to talk to you. But no person would ever say that in 1 million years. But I could see somebody singing that in a rock opera style thing. It's just, I don't know. Maybe that was the whole rhythm of it that was just not quite clicking with me in this first issue.
Well, and I do think, like, it's just so many bad things happen, which in a song is just like, yes, it's all one thing. But in, there are so many breaks between the bad things happening. I was like, is this just like a bleak march toward this person's life? Even at the end, she's like, the interviewer is like, so wait, what was happening? She's like, wait, it gets worse. And I was like, what? No.
She's like, possible. Shut up and listen. The creepy twin girls really creep me out. So I was having a hard time with this, but yeah.
Wow, you're just talking about how your friends love this hardcore shit, and you're like, I saw a picture of two girls who look alike, and I'm terrified.
That's right. Creepy twin kids, man, they freak me out.
They're just twin kids.
They're just twins. No, have you ever seen twins?
No offense. Yes, I have.
And?
In my school, there was two twins, and they had like a secret language, and they freaked everybody out.
So when you say there were two twins, were there two people who were twins, or were there four twins?
What? Maybe it was four this whole time, and I thought it was two.
All right. I guess we'll never find out. Back to Pete's high school to investigate.
Find out at the reunion, Pete.
Yeah. JSA number 5 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Diego Olortegui. In this issue, the JSA is still battling the Justice Society, who just wants to wreck them. They're going to wreck them and wreck them and wreck them and wreck them. And that's pretty much the plot of this book. I'm surprised, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but I'm surprised how straightforward this superhero book is for Jeff Lemire.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that goes down in this issue. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot, so it was impressive how quickly we kind of churn through things.
Well, and that's what I feel like, there is so much going on and so much jumping around to the different situations that's the real where the heft of the work has to go. Like trying to hold this story where we have multiple Obsidians, one dying, one lying here, right?
And see what they did there?
That's what I did. And it's just so much going on. I actually really like the Kid Eternity sort of things happening here. I'm looking forward to when the story gets a little bit more narrow and more sort of concise so that we can get to this. Because I really like Dr. Fate's Tower as this big prize and all the characters racing toward it. But it's just a little, it's stretching the bonds of the narrative, I think, where it is right now in this issue.
Just to jump on something you said, yeah, I'm really looking forward to what's next, because this issue, we kind of did a lot of building up to something, and I'm hoping it's going to pay off.
Speaking of stretching narratives, Web of Spider-Verse, #1 from Marvel, written by Matt Groom, Jordan Morris, Greg Pak, Chris Eliopoulos, art by Luciano Vecchio, Sumit Kumar, Alan Robinson, Federico Vincentini, and Chris Eliopoulos. This is setting up the Spider-Verse versus Venom-Verse event that is coming our way shortly. And here we're getting three stories of multiversal Spider-Men, with one of them going to be chosen as a champion to lead them all. All snark at the beginning there aside, I actually thought this was a very fun collection of three stories and change. I like the Spider-Hulk one. I thought Jordan Morris's, I'm forgetting what he's actually called, but like Count Parker, is that who it was?
The Count, I think.
Yeah. Just Vampire Spider-Man was very fun and had a great tone to it as well. Overall, I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, and plus the my favorite was the spider toy kind of panel at the back, the comic panel, where you got Sandman and the
Chris Eliopoulos stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the sandbox, that was a blast.
When I first opened this, I was like, more characters in the Spider-Verse? The one thing we have too many of in the Spider-Verse is spider people. But I agree with you, Alex. I did enjoy this. It's a nice little way of doing it. And I feel like what we're getting at the end of this issue is that they're doing this on the Venom side, too, perhaps next week, which is cool. A good way to give us a little anthology series leading into an event without saying what it is, I guess.
Yeah. Next up, Monkey Meat, the Summer Batch, number one from Image Comics by Judy Ba. This is Judy Ba's chance to really cut free and do some absolutely crazy wild stuff, all set on an island that has a factory that serves monkey meat made of monkey parts. But that's doesn't really exactly have a plot so much as whatever Judy Ba wants to do. Here we're getting a lot of different stories, one that parodies superhero literature, another one that is nearly silent, among other things. What'd you guys think about this book?
Yeah, this is a blast. I think it's silly and fun, and the emoji speak, and it's just really kind of a cool, interesting thing, and great use of middle fingers in this. So great art. This is a great time. I love this.
Yeah, and let's not forget to highlight all the other fingers that are out here doing great work, and thumbs. great all across the board. I like this as well. Great restrained color palette in the art, which was cool, eye-catching. And just tonally and sort of story-wise, this reminded me of, like, Mad Magazine Spy versus Spy.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of it. Fun. If you're a fan of that, I think this is a good book to pick up.
Justice League, The Atom Project, number three from DC Comics, written by John Lidley and Ryan Parrott, art by Mike Perkins. The Atoms have finally managed to track down Captain Atom, and we find out more about what has been going on with him. We also get a look at The Atom Project and what is going weird and wrong there. I continue to be pleasantly surprised how dark this book is. There's a whole thing with Adam Smasher where he has been horribly malformed that is really hard to read in a good way. Like, it's purposely like, oh my God, this is so sad.
Yeah, this comic, like, which, as we've talked about, is right up against this major DC event, is really just casting nuance on all of these characters in a way where I'm like, everyone's a little bit fucked up and implicit here in doing a bad thing for different reasons. But it's a great story. I don't know where it's going in a way that I find really keeps pulling me along.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of Adams fighting in this. Great art and action, but I don't know. This something lost me on this one. Maybe it's just because Adam isn't my guy or something. I don't know. But
and there's two of them here, and then a Captain Adam.
Yeah, so it's...
And then it's Adam Smasher.
It's kind of really flying over my head.
All right. Just like Adams all the time, flying over your head. Next up... Blade Forger, number one from Man Cave Studios, written by Inaki Miranda and Roy Miranda, art by Inaki Miranda. And I will say up front, I was very surprised about this, but I think this is my favorite issue of the week.
Whoa! Ooh.
And the reason is this starts
out... Blade?
Starts out with a very typical narrative of a kid who, from the moment he's born, is destined to be the greatest swordsman of his time. He competes in tournaments throughout all the land that is sort of like a mix of steampunk and post-apocalypse and a million other sort of like fantasy settings. There's monsters, there's giant knights, etc. And reading most of the book, I felt like, okay, I've read this a million times before. I get it. We're going to, you know, see him continue to fight his way up and become emperor, etc. I don't want to spoil what happens in the last third of the book, but it completely recontextualizes everything that goes on there in this way that kind of made my jaw drop a little bit. Like, they give this 1-2 punch of changing where the narrative is taking place. And then at the very end, they give it this emotional punch that felt to me like almost on par with the way Daniel Warren Johnson does things in terms of, oh, what you were reading this whole time and everything that we've been saying, it's not what you think it was. It's actually this other, much smaller, much more personal thing. So very blown away by this book. I went from being like, all right, prove it to me, to 100% on board for issue 2.
Same. Like, I felt the same way reading it. I was like, okay, a little intro to a world. A Neo-style hero is rising to take it over. And then there's a point where it just the story tips across that. And we see, like, him age. And then a great reveal at the end that was so refreshing over the course of it. Like, I agree. This was such a fun first issue.
Yeah, I thought this was awesome and loved all the action, like the kind of reveal stuff. And yeah, I mean, I think we've all been a little kid with our first sword being that excited and stuff like that. So pretty cool.
And I also want to give a shout out to the art, which is very dynamic. Like, it's just very solid characters, but every once in a while it sort of stretches out a little bit into more manga styled action. There's one shot of him, I think it's, if I recall correctly, jumping upside down and cutting a raindrop in half,
yes,
which feels like it's straight out of anime or something like that. So great,
very
art.
Subtly done too. That you just see a tiny panel with a raindrop sliced in half, and I was like, "Ooh, slick,
yeah, pretty yeah. cool."
And Pete, you said you were always remember your first sword. How many swords are you on now? What's your still the first one?
No, man,
still number one.
No, there's a lot of fun stuff.
And sorry, just to check, you're not talking about the knives in your cutlery drawer because they look like swords, but they're supposed to be used for dinner.
Oh, or perhaps the swords in your cocktail that usually have a cherry on them.
No, those pirate ones, the little plastic ones. Yeah. Love those, yeah, man.
That probably was your first sword when you think about it.
If you went to a bar and they were like, sword or umbrella, what would you choose?
Sword all day.
Sword always. Yeah,
really?
Hell yeah.
Always. Yeah.
I love those swords. And I'll tell you what, they're fucking dangerous.
Oh, man.
You hand that to a kid, that thing, you could stab a human. No problem.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's happened. I couldn't believe they handed those to us as kids.
Yeah, I almost pierced my lip on one of them.
There was, of course, a Shirley Temple. But I feel like there was a point when we were kids where they were like, it's actually called a kiddie cocktail. Because it's like, boys don't want Shirley Temples. I was like, I just want that cherry juice, guy. I don't care what it's called. But the kiddie cocktails would come with a sword and two cherries on them. And it was like giving a kid a sugar treat that makes him aggressive and a weapon to do damage with.
Yeah. Running around with a tiny sword in one hand, candy cigarettes in the other.
Yeah.
Living your best life.
What a time. Birds of Prey, number 19 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Juan Cabal. In this issue, we're wrapping up a couple of arcs here. One where Black Canary is potentially going to be assassinated. Don't worry, she's fine. And meanwhile, Barda and Cassandra Cain are trying to get Constantine back from a demon spirit dimension. Two really fun stories. I kind of thought they would combine or clash together in some way, but...
Nope.
And that's okay. They were a good time.
Yeah. First off, cool cover, you know. But yeah, this is really just really glorious comics. I'm having such a great time with Birds of Prey. It continues to deliver. Badass story, amazing art. More of this, please, and thank you.
This is the most one of the most consistent comics on the stands. It's excellent. Month in and month out. Like, beautiful art, great story, tension built, fun being had. Barda and Cassandra Cain are great, man, in this issue specifically, and some great dread at the end of the issue. I just love this creative team. I love this team of characters. I just want this to keep going forever.
Yes, please.
Here's a title that's not going forever, Living Hell, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics by Caitlin Yarsky. This is the final issue of the title about a demon who is tasked with hunting down other demons. The cliffhanger of the last issue was he needed to hunt down none other than his own daughter because she has demonic blood, and it all comes down here. I thought this was a fantastic series. Caitlin Yarsky is incredible at art, but the creature designs here are next level in this issue. But also, like we were talking about a couple of issues back, there's just a real sadness and poignancy here to everything that's going on. So nice level of emotion, really fascinating take on demons, and some fantastic art. This is a great series that if you missed, definitely go pick up the issues or eventually when it's in trade.
Perhaps I was fooling myself, but I thought this was going to keep going for longer than 4 issues. Mm-hmm. And the world that was set up here, I thought was worthy of really continuing. The lines being laid down, I thought, oh, we could get this for at least 6 to 8, 12 beyond. And maybe we'll get more on a second season of this. But I was bummed to see it go because I also really enjoyed it.
Yeah. first off, amazing cover. This the art and style, to the paneling, to the way this flows. It's just really nice for the reader. This is such a cool, crazy issue. A lot goes down, and the twists and turns. It's just really, really impressive. And the demons and monsters that are drawn here are just really unbelievable looking. And like Zelbatron was saying, the kind of like emotion that you see on the faces and stuff, really impressive.
Poison Ivy, number 31 from DC Comics, written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Brian Level. In this issue, we finally get revealed what happened to the Marshlands, thanks to some investigation from Ivy. And as you'd expect, it's pretty horrific what went on in this small town. Definitely leading me to think, my big thought coming out of here, other than this title is always good, is everybody's like, in the real world, is always like, why do they live in Gotham City? It's so terrible. Here's the thing. Suburbs outside Gotham City, also terrible.
Death.
Horrible. Yeah. We've had in Batman Dark Patterns, we had that suburb where nobody could feel pain and they completely fell apart. Now we have this marshland that everybody drowned and went insane in. Don't live anywhere is the takeaway.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why people stay in Gotham. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Living in this stab town is where I grew up on the outskirts.
Go ahead.
Is it inconsistent for me to say that this is also one of the most consistent books on the stand?
Yep.
Because it is. And
it is.
The ebb and flow of the different arcs of this, there's always something boiling. Like to have Janet from HR lean over and talking to an acorn, I was like, right.
Dude, the reveal that Janet from HR is working for Big Acorn was just, oh my God, jaw-dropping moment.
Do you think she's like, going nuts?
I think she is. Yeah.
I mean, she is. Yeah.
She is.
It's working. Yeah.
In a big way. Yeah. You talk to a giant acorn, you are going nuts. Yeah. But I love this art. I love this storytelling. This is an amazing team on this book, and they've been killing it for 31 issues. So it's a blast.
Talking to a big acorn and fucking a crocodile? That's a wild life.
Yeah. Plus, you got a guy who's just a suit and a flower. I mean, what the heck is going on here?
Oh, a flower face? Yeah.
Yeah.
The underlying dread that this comic has been able to create for 31 issues. We had Kyle Higgins on the live show this past week.
Talked about
how not a lot of comics last past 30 issues. And this comic that we thought when we first opened the first issue, it was like, oh, this is a fun limited series. Still going strong, still keeping it going all this time.
Technically, it started as a mini series. Shout out to Trivia.
This was featured, creator and comic was featured in Trivia also on the live show.
Yeah,
if you want to hear some very basic trivia, check it out.
And if I recall correctly, I believe it was also a tribute to Gene Hackman. Is that? That can't be right, but I believe that was correct.
How could you ever do those two things at once?
Double down on the G's, you know, G. Willow Wilson and Gene Hackman.
Okay, all right.
That makes sense.
I hate that look I just got inside of your brain. Hyde Street, number 4 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Ivan Rice. This issue, we're finally, after 4 issues, getting the origin of the matinee monster. Is that the name of it?
Correct.
Sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's another tragic creature on Hyde Street. The twist here is this is one who does not want to take souls, and we find out why and how. Still really liking the tone of this series, and the overall mythology makes it very intriguing to check back in with month after month.
Yeah, I agree. This continues to be really cool. We kind of get our Frankenstein's monster story in here. Love the back matter. Love the Hyde Street amusements kind of stuff. Reminds me of the old kind of like ordering catalogs back in the day. But yeah, just fun, amazing art. This continues to be very enjoyable.
I think Jeff Johns is really doing a lot of great work structurally with Hyde Street. And this issue is really cool in that way. We get a great sequence of our main character being put into his Frankenstein's monster's makeup, which I thought was awesome. And then the reluctance of his transformation into being a monster I thought was really great. And his classic Hollywood thing of being like, don't hit my eyes, that's my moneymaker, I thought was very fun and funny. And continuing to build a sort of weird, intriguing, and compelling underlying universe and narrative is fun.
The Dice House by the Sea, number 6 from DC Comics, written by James Tynion IV, art by Alvaro Martinez Bueno. In this issue, more stuff is happening between the Dice House and them.
It's great.
Yeah. Stuff happens. There's pages.
That's accurate. Yeah. That's accurate.
There's several pages in here and a cover, and I believe it's going to be released in comic book shops.
Wow. And perhaps has been.
Yes. Now, things are heating up between the Nice House by the Sea and the Nice House by the Lake. The thing that this issue really drives it on is that the people from the Nice House by the Lake are like, we should become friends with them. And the Nice House by the Sea is like, how are we going to
kill them?
Yes. And meanwhile, we're diving more into the relationship between these two alien beings that run these two houses. Great series. I don't know what else I could say at this point.
It's funny because it's so much big sort of sci-fi fantasy storytelling, while at the same time it's huge interpersonal relationship, like deep dive into the intricacies of how relationships we have, especially when we're young, just live large in our lives for the rest of our lives. And like, it's amazing that, I mean, James Tynion is such a concise writer, and he's able to thread all of that the density on both sides of this story. Every time I read it, I'm like, I should go back and reread all of these issues before I read this issue. But by the end of it, I'm like, I know what happened. So I bet I would be enriched, though, if I did go back and reread all of them before each one, because it is building towards something very specific.
Yeah. JT Ford continues to be killing the game here. The cool cover, the ending blew my mind. This is amazing storytelling and creepy ass amazing art.
Do you ever read this book and think he's probably writing about his friends?
Definitely 100%. The specificity, especially of the text pages in here, we get 3 email based text pages. I was like, by the third one, I was like, did he write these to someone and then just put them in here?
Yeah.
They feel very real.
Yeah.
I think he was just kind of like house hunting for houses by the sea and it all kind of.
What do you think he's going to go for next? Like Gowanus Canal or?
Oh, man.
Do you feel like Gowanus, James.
The gross James house bought by the Gowanus Canal.
James has bought 2 houses based on the success of these books.
Absolutely.
He's like he's like lake, sea. He's looking for like mountain or close to beach. The DC offices.
Yeah. The Terminator number 5 from Dynamite, written by Declan Shalvey, art by Joe Mulvey. In this issue, it's Terminator in space.
Oh.
That's it.
Yep.
What did you think of this book? Sorry, I didn't say that part.
No, I mean, it's Terminator in space, and these poor astronauts, you know, they never had a chance. And, you know, spoilers, but throwing a Terminator head into the Earth's atmosphere as it kind of, like, you know, catches on fire is cool-looking art panel, that's for sure.
I like that even the Terminators are a little bit confused when he's in space. He's like, holy shit, it's hard up here. He's flying around and the astronaut's like, what am I imagining this? Really, everyone has a hard time with the reality of what's happening in this. But I think the biggest thing to highlight with this series is just the stretching of the Terminator canon that Declan Shalvey's doing by continuing to put Terminators in interesting places with interesting, you know, basically one-off. There was a two-parter earlier on, but mostly short stories about a Terminator showing up at different time periods, and that's. It's if you're at all a fan of Terminator, you should definitely pick this up because it expands the universe in a way that nothing else is going to do.
And last but not least, TMNT Night Watcher, number 6 from IDW, written by Junie Ba, art by Pharaoh Pei. I was surprised to learn by the end here that there's only one more issue of this title, which is teaming up Jenica with a weird, massive costume. And there's a big old, what is he, like a wolf? Wolf, a dog?
I think he's a bear.
He's a bear. Bear man. Bear wolf? Yes, a bear man. Bear man who's really taunting her, basically is Jenica's Joker, one might say. So a bunch of stuff going on here. Great art. Wish there was more of it, because I also felt like this one was just getting started.
Yeah, I agree. This had great stuff in it. I love the Jenica showdown with the kind of robot Night Watcher here and cool build. I'm excited for what's next, and I'm sad that it's not that much more, but I'm still going to read what's coming out next issue because I've been loving this. This has been great.
No, I'm
Jenica,
done.
One of my...
I'm done. No more. I'm going to stop here before the final issue. Go ahead, Justin.
Wow.
Oh, man. Well, that's depressing.
Yeah. Why are you getting off the train? Yeah. The magic armor train.
I always do that. I get off one stop before wherever I need to go. Because
you need the steps?
Yeah, I need the steps, man.
Nice. Yeah. And let's not forget, for those of you listening, Alex and Pete share a workout app so they can track
each
other's...
Let me see how Pete's doing today.
Oh, stop it. I wasn't...
Here, I'll talk about my review of this comic while you check if Pete's been keeping his heart.
Oh, that's not... No, man, don't.
Tuesdays. Just wait 1 second. I enjoyed this comic. Jenica's one of my favorite turtles. I feel like this series got into some sort of very unique areas of the TMNT universe. Would like to see more of it. And if I know the TMNT universe, they always bring back the characters that are working.
Today's a recovery day, all right? I worked out yesterday, so don't fucking judge me.
No, I hear you, but I actually have a question that doesn't make any sense to me. For your
steps. 4 steps, Pete? 4?
-5? For your stand hours, you have 14 out of 12 hours standing. How are you standing up for 14 hours, Pete? You've been sitting down for several hours. I've been watching you.
Pete sleeps in a stand-up bed like a coffin.
I hang upside down.
You have a Murphy bed that you just don't know how to put down?
Yeah.
You got folded.
He just leans against his comics and falls asleep every night and has the sweetest dreams.
All right. Well, I guess that's that. And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts, we do patreon.com/comicbookclub for ad-free versions of this podcast, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast, and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Please, Pete needs a fitness trainer so much. Immediately, someone step in. And if I ever become a serial killer, my murder weapon will be plastic pirate swords. Keep your eyes on the news.
Oh, wow. What a reveal. And they